SiriusXM Sports presents At the Races with Steve Bick. Horse racing, handicapping, interviews. This is At the Races with Steve Bick.
From Saratoga Racecourse on an absolutely gorgeous morning. That's a welcome change from what we've been assaulted with up here. Really nice after yet one more day of thunderstorms and a little bit of mayhem. It got through yesterday okay, and as a result, everybody's going to be, I think, looking forward to today, tomorrow, weekend, and nice and cool, too. Storms came through, did whatever they were going to do, and now we're, it feels like upstate New York. A nice, comfortable, dry morning, and a little less activity on this Thursday than there was opening day a week ago. Actually, you know what? Get in your car, folks. I'm just looking around right here in the quad. I'm by Lou Cabell's credential office, administration building across the way, racing office to my left. And there's empty a number of empty picnic tables. So if you were undecided about today, get motivated. Gather up friends and family and hop in the car. It's 9 o'clock, 9:02. So you got plenty of time. There will be not just a steeplechase race today after yesterday's postponement of the Kaiser. There will be the Grade 1, Patty Smithwick. And I put up a really cool cartoon on my Twitter feed and a great picture of one of the all-time greats, and Patty and Mikey Smithwick, brothers, jockey trainer combo, into the 50s and 60s until a very bad spill at Monmouth ended Patty Smithwick's riding career. But then he trained for a while, died young too, died of lung cancer in his 40s, and almost 400 wins, 398 steeplechase wins. We'll let Sean Clancy, who's going to join us in about 15 minutes, we'll let Sean put that into perspective. I mean, it's second all time, and there's a picture I put up of Patty on Neji, Hall of Famer for Mrs. Phipps. And in fact, that picture, I didn't have room. I ran out of characters on Twitter, but the picture is at Saratoga, over the fence that had at the time the water hazard. You know, sort of like a miniature golf course, like you saw Andy and Anthony the other day. You had to have seen that, right? Kind of a fun outing. You heard Andy with me on Tuesday that they were going to go scout out a miniature golf course to use for the fundraiser that they're doing, and they ended up playing themselves out there and had fun. They went to Martha's for ice cream, so kind of fun. Got a big kick out of that. But you see that trough of water, and you know, it's more aesthetic than it is, compared to certainly to the cross country courses in eventing, where the horses very frequently are, you know, land in water and have to run through water hazards. Pretty amazing. So Sean will be here to talk about the Smithwick, and he's got the favorite, his River D stable, Jim Bufaro. And not going to be easy because Leslie Young with Redisian, 2-1, Galway Kid, Kerry Brion, who of course has taken over for Jonathan Shepherd. She's got the trio in here, including Galway Kid and Baltimore Bucko, who campaigned in the UK over the winter, and French Light as well.
So group of six, and then you've got Jack Fisher with a little bit of a outsider, Cite, and actually there's no accent, so it's Sight. if it had a little accent over the E, it would be Cite. I that launched a product years ago in Canada at Price Club, Club Price, called Diversite. So there's the always valuable international experience, such as it is. And by the way, we're excited. Tina told me, I guess you saw the note, that we can, later in August, we can cross the border into Canada. So I guarantee you we'll, not this summer. We got enough travel planned as it is. And speaking of travel, it feels like we are going to get down over the next 2 weeks to Virginia. I was cajoled and then formally invited to make that trip down to Colonial, and I think we're going to do that. Woodbury Payne called me yesterday after I got off the air, and he said, and also Debbie Easter sent me a note and said, we want you to come down. So I said to Tina, do you want to go to Virginia? And what we'll do is we'll leave on a Sunday after the TV show, and we'll go down to Williamsburg, and then broadcast from the track on Monday, and then hustle back. It'll be a lot, but it's about, Woodbury says, about an eight-hour drive. So, speaking of TV, by the way, quick aside, because it's what, 9:06. I've got to do the Capital OTB play of the day in about 4 minutes, 3-4 minutes, and it occurs to me that I think we're set up, but I'm not sure how they're. I guess they have to signal me somehow. They're gonna have to point to me or something, and let me know that it's time to give the play of the day. And when it comes to this card, this is kind of a funky card today, and I'm sure we'll do some handicapping later when Seth comes by as well. And I ended up. I won't. You know, take away the drama of the play of the day. But I did something a little different than I normally would. But there's a horse that stands out, I thought, today in that regard. There's actually a couple in the two maiden races. There's two favorites that are particularly, feel particularly strong. Talk a little bit about, you know, some of yesterday's results as well. And Indiana, too, the two stakes and the races we went over with Bill Downs. From a Saratoga perspective, obviously the feature, the Run Curtis Run, Michael Dubb and Michael Caruso. Interesting to see Caruso campaign just under his name as opposed to Bethlehem Stables. And Run Curtis Run, the Summerfront colt, was bred by Larry Goichman, actually. And this one, wire to wire under Jose Ortiz, was actually third choice. He ended up getting $8 in the Rick Violette. And yesterday, a smashing success for the Thoroughbred Aftercare Day. Worked out really well. Couple of other performances, Dub with another win, and Caruso also partnered up with Sol Cumin, Matticat. Let's be clear that War Down, Take the Back Roads. And Take the Back Roads was a very good pick, I thought, by certainly a good pick by Shapazian, and looked like a winner fairly late. But Let's Be Clear kept, under Gaffleone, kept plugging away. The upset in the sequence, by the way, going back to, I think this, was it the, would have been the seventh. And the seventh was a, ended up being a winner that tripped things up. I tried that Fair-Haired Boy, who did come running, but was too late on the scene, and took money. Took a bunch of money, ended up going off at under 5-1. But frontman, Joel Rosario, boy, oh boy, that was a nice ride. And frontman sweeps from the outside. And I was surprised that Gaffleone was where he was, a little further back than mid-pack with Fairhaired Boy, and was left with a little bit to do. Put in a decent run to end up second, beating a couple of lengths. But the Pioneer, the Nile, that was bred by the Lowe's, marked in Cantamarcy and America's Pastime Stables with the baseball. Get a kick out of it. Winners 25-20. And that was the tough horse for the most part in the sequence. And I was shocked, actually. Shiraz, 11-2. A hell of a number on Shiraz, winning that turf sprint ninth. Luis Saez. I tried Alfalfa, who seemed to kind of sink in to the turf a little bit. Ran okay and was able to get third. So ended up salvaging a little something. That was the best result for me of the day, really, in terms of a return. And I'm looking at Brian and Anthony Mormino, assuming that at some point they're gonna give me a signal that they want me to cut in with the play of the day. So I'll watch, and I don't know if they take a. I think they maybe take a commercial break. Is that how they do it? This is the first time we've tried this live. I've done it by tape so far. Putting a little 2-minute video together. Anyway, yesterday. Saratoga, solid, just a nice day of racing, and we'll get, I'm sure, back to more of that when Seth visits, and as I wait for a signal from these guys. Indiana, quick run down there, and Bill Downs and I thought kind of got through this okay. Mojo Man talked about Jimmy DeVito and Dash Goff, the Stay Thirsty gelding, with a very nice performance at a second choice, and paid $6.60 to win the Send It In Army. The tough horse in the sequence was Covenant Lady, that paid $12, and Tony Granitz. In fact, Granitz runs 1-2 in that spot. Monday Call, we did discuss a little bit that Brad Cox I came very close to guaranteeing victory, and at 1-2, Monday Call had to kind of dig in and get past the Bernie Flint pace setter, Euphoric, who ran very well. But ultimately, Giroux, who made the trip to ride Monday Call, and gets up three-quarters of a length to win the Clarksville. The three horses that Bill focused on, Prado's Playboy, Jackson Gold, and Rockin' All Night, 1-2-3 in that allowance. And then, you did have another upsetter. And I got a nice effort from Shine On Brad at 10-1, but it didn't really work. Ended up settling for third. I guess they're ready. Over here. Yeah, you ready, Brian? I'm gonna. Should I start? Should I start talking as if it's play of the day? Yes? Give me a nod to me if this is... Yes? You got me? Yeah? I let me pull up their audio. Maybe they'll hear back. I knew this was a little bit of a... of a risk. Yeah? Yes? All right, I got a thumbs up. Okay, yeah, go ahead. You're telling me to go ahead. It's the DePaula play of the day. I'm doing something that I don't normally do. I'm going to use a maiden out of that sixth race, the state-bred two-year-old fillies, Derry Nain. And it just feels like if there's a likely winner on the card, Derry Nain, the Waterville Lake homebred, kind of stands out from a pedigree standpoint. Quality rode out of the hard-spun stake-winning mare Port McGee. She won the license fee downstate, the turf sprinter herself. So Derry Nain working very steadily and very nicely. Got plus comments from the DRF clocking report. You get Joel Rosario. Obviously, Clement can win with a firster. And so Derry Nain, 5-2. Probably gets bet down a little bit below that. There are some horses that have started in this group that might take a little bit of money. George Abro with Quick Power Nap is a firster that's going to get a little money. But Derry Nain, I think your DePaula play of the day today. And see if we can't get back in the plus column. Had a decent run, as I mentioned earlier, yesterday after the opening day winner. So, Derry Nain, the 3 in the 6th race, your DePaula play of the day. Good luck, everybody.
Thank you, Steve Bick, ladies and gentlemen, turning our attention to the...
There we go. That worked, I guess. I think I was a little late coming in. Oh, look at this. In the special mobile, like Batman, he rolls in. Holy cow. Sean Clancy, everybody, your call. You can do the stick mic or the headset. Go with the stick mic. You've got a guy. You look like a guy that handles that'll handle a stick mic successfully.
Good morning.
Good morning, Mr. Grade 1 favorite.
Man, I'm trying not to think about it.
I figured.
Like 9-5 and a grade 1, that's a first.
I was going to say, right? This is the lowest price in a setting like this?
For my stable, for sure. I mean, if you look at his form, we brought him up here a couple different times in grade 1s, and he's never been... never been this price. But it's a short competitive field, and, it's old cliche, but it's just good to be here. You know, you want to compete, you want to be in a place like this, so we're excited.
The Patty Smithwick, and I gave, I don't know if you saw the thing I put up this morning. Did you see the tweet?
Of course.
So cool, and the picture of him on Neji going over the water, the water barrier. It's sort of like a miniature golf. It's more aesthetic. Now, I don't know, when did they take those out?
Long before I started riding. I mean, back in the day, they had natural fences, so they had a big cedar, cedar stuffed hurdles and chase fences. They had two different courses up here and Belmont and places like that, and then they went to the portable fences and early 70s, so it's certainly I think when they switched that, they didn't, that was the end of that.
Rudy Rodriguez
is our fan club. We're getting heckled. I'm not even sure. We might have been getting heckled.
From him, probably. Exactly.
Spanish heckling.
Give everybody. I've discussed him more, I think, with. And obviously, he predates us, and was gone in the 60s. But Patty Smithwick and his brother Mikey were a unique brother pairing that just dominated. 398 wins for Patty before that fall at Monmouth, and I don't even know how many Mikey ended up with. But as formidable a pairing as I'm. Not just limited to steeplechase either.
No, they did it all. I mean, Mikey Smith, they were training for Mrs. Ogden Phipps, who was one of the biggest owners in steeplechasing. And you look back at the horses they had. I mean, they were by just unbelievable pedigrees and unbelievable race records. And horses were running. They were like, I remember they had one old jumper, Top Bid, maybe, or one of those old horses. Like, he ran in the Hopeful and then came, and then he ended up being a steeplechase horse at the end. I mean, he's a champion. But yeah, they were dominant for me. I was a kid growing up, and for me, there was the numbers. The numbers were out there growing up. It was Joe Aitchison, 440 all-time record. Patty Smithwick, 398. Dooley Adams, 301. Jerry Fishback, 301. Tommy Walsh, 253. All the way down, and that's how I grew up looking at those numbers. And just they were just. If you're a kid growing up in baseball, you knew the numbers that were out there, and you tried to, that's what you always wanted to be. And so Yeah, they were just icons of our game. They dominated up here. I mean, Mikey was champion trainer, you know, probably 6, 8, 10 times. Patty Smith was champion jockey. Patty Smith, I got to admit, kind of an unusual style. He'd sit way back, keep his hands real low, but he'd sit way back, let his reins slide over those big fences back then. And, yeah, just heroes of mine growing up.
Atchison, I brought this up maybe last summer or the summer before. Why, there should be a stake named for Joe, no?
Yeah, there was, actually. We had a novice stake at Pimlico for several years called the Joe Atchison. I was lucky enough to win it once. And while he was still alive, he came in and he presented the trophy. It's one of my, like, proudest moments of Joe Atchison presenting a trophy after winning his race. And then we lost that race. And, yeah, there really isn't another one. I mean, I need to come up with one. And he's the all-time. I mean, he's the all-time greatest. I was lucky enough. My father trained at Delaware Park, and Joe Atchison would come and rent a room from us. We lived in a big tenant house of the Ross family. Had all these crazy little nooks and crannies, and had one little upstairs room that had its kind of own separate entrance. And Joe Atchison would come and stay with us every summer because all the jumpers would go to Delaware Park before they came up here. It was a big circuit. I mean, they had a lot of jump races at Delaware. So there, I'm 6, 7, 8 years old, and my hero is living in my house. You know, and I mean, I'm sure I just bugged the poor man to death. You know, he drove this little orange kind of car, the kind of yellowish orange little car. I'd see it come in the driveway, you know, I'd bust out the door, meet Joe Atchison when he stepped out of the car. Great memories, you know, for me, that's what you wanted to be. I mean, I didn't want to be anything other than Joe Atchison. I mean, wanted to be. And Patty Smith, because he was a little bit before, like, I'd never really seen Patty Smith ride. I mean, I read about him, saw the pictures. I mean, I'd read the Steeplechase book, you know, the annual yearbook. I mean, I just read that cover to cover. But Joe Atchison, he was riding then, and that was just, I just never forget it. He was the first guy I ever saw wear shoulder pads, obviously long before a flak jacket, but he had these two, had two shoulder pads he would wear, and he had them kind of strapped together with basically string. They were just like two pads on both shoulders, and he'd do this kind of figure eight of string to tie them on. And he had two crazy bluebirds tattoos, right, kind of on either side. Kind of right below his collarbone. So he's crazy looking bluebirds that I remember thinking, wow, like Joe Atchison's got, you know, these two bluebird tattoos. And I remember the shoulder pads. And I mean, I just remember every horse he rode. And you know, it's just, I was like, you're just like living, you know, you just got like Mickey Mantle living in your house. You know, it's just incredible.
Well, it's funny you bring up baseball, because the thing I think of is my father grew up in Brooklyn once he came over from Austria, and you know, the Dodgers all lived, and this is not unique just to the Dodgers, but you know, they lived in you know, right in the neighborhood of Ebbets Field, and in some cases they boarded with other, you know, with families. Sure. Took a room. And and also the Atchisons, the father was pitched for the Dodgers, as it happens. Wow. But he, you know, as opposed to like the Smithwicks and other, you know, Irish imports, they were Marylanders, right? Maryland family.
Very big Maryland family, and you know, huge in the game. Joseph Leader Atchison Senior, that was Joe's dad. He trained horses, trained the Great Tuscalee, which is just an icon of our game. I think he won more. I think he holds the record for most wins of any steeplechase horse. Just another icon of the game. And they lived on Riding Stable Road. I remember I'd write letters. I still have every one of them. I would write letters to Joe Atchison.
Unbelievable.
When I was a kid. So I was born in 1970. Joe Atchison was riding through that, and I was always sending him letters, and he wrote these letters back. I mean, he would write me back. Every time I wrote him a letter, he'd write back, and he'd read his letters, and it's like, you know, he said, "Dear Shaw, I'm so happy to hear that you were able to go to Saratoga for the summer," or, you know, "So great to hear you're playing baseball," or, you know, hope the move went well. We had moved, you know, he just, you know, he'd draw this little he draw a little horse head at the bottom of the of his letters. And I mean, I must have, I've got to have 50 letters from Joe
Aceson. That's very cool.
Yeah, it just, when he, when I was actually, it was really interesting. He, I'll never forget this. When I was trying to be champion jockey, I was champion jockey once, and I was in 13 years. So it's like, you know, so it's like really pressure that year. I was right near the top, and he was galloping horses for Tim Keefe, who's a great friend of mine at Laurel.
Sure.
And Tim called me and said, Joe gave me something he wants you to have. And I was like, okay. So I like got together with Tim, and he handed me this envelope. And had Sean, and this, I could just tell Joe Aitchison's writing. I had Sean and this great cursive writing. And I opened it up, and it was a one page front and back of like a, it was like a yellow legal pad, one sheet. And it had Joe Aitchison's notes about riding races.
Ooh.
And he just had these, you know, all these, like, you know, if you're on, you're just little in his writing, and then he'd have little where he'd add stuff on the sides and little notes, and it would just everything from, you know, when you're on the inside, make sure your horse pays attention to the fence, not the horse outside him. You know, when you turn for home, gather him up and get him up in the bridle for the last fence. At Fair Hill, make sure you angle the last and make sure the horse outside use, you know, angling it as well. I mean, just these like classic notes. I mean, it was just like, so yeah, that was a real honor that he gave it to me. You know,
very much
incredible, right? So yeah, I'll never forget that.
He lived to 85.
Yeah, lovely guy. I mean, just he galloped horses up to the end. I mean, one of the gallop horses to the end. He was still riding a little bit. He galloped for Tim for years, and worked for Leatherberry. He galloped for Leatherberry for a long time, and then he galloped for Tim for a long time. And yeah, just a hero of mine.
I love it. I'm glad we went in this direction, and introducing the. Funny that the first jump race of the season ends up being a grade one after yesterday. And, you know, the explain, Sean, from your perspective and understanding the pressures that the racing office deals with as to why, I mean, certainly the turf sprint that was run yesterday on wet grass and on you know, some loam with plenty of give to it, that's going to tear the course up more than a jump race, frankly, especially considering that where the jump race is conducted isn't where the flat turf races are conducted. But I mean, to me, it sort of sends a misguided message about danger. I mean, of soft turf, because the danger of the soft turf isn't while it's soft.
No question. No, I mean, our races are much safer for the horses and riders when there is some cut in the ground, when there is some give. I mean, our races when it's really firm ground, they go faster, and it's a much more delicate balance when it's firm. So, you know, it's for the steeplechase horses, it's not really a safety thing as far as running on soft turf. I understand, Naira. I mean, I understand the management. I understand what they need to do. Yesterday, it seemed like certainly could have run the jump race. I mean, they ran two turf races after that, but we get it. We, you know, we understand it, and you know, we're happy to be here. And you know, and they don't cancel the race. They basically postpone it and bring it back for another day, which they've always done. Which, so, you know, if you run it, whether it runs yesterday or next week or whatever, we're happy to be here and happy to run.
Boy, you want to talk about old jump jocks and horsemen? So you want to sit down for a minute? You got to run.
I got to go inspect the course.
Speaking of, that's what we're talking about. Woodbury Payne, everybody. Speak into that mic for a second. Say hello.
Hello. I didn't know what Steve was asking.
I just wanted you to you know, provide a you know, a bon mot, as it were.
Yeah. Footing's going to be great. Everything's going to be super. I'm just going out there to check it one last time.
All right,
we run.
Go walk the course. You, are you going to high heels like Michael Dickinson or not?
Oprah wouldn't let me have them.
Come back over when you're done. That's specifically what we're talking about, with as it happens, is the nature of the course. And Woodbury, who is the steeplechase steward in the stand for the bouncing back and forth from Colonial now and all summer long.
Yeah, Woodbury Payne gives a lot to our game, donates a lot of time and effort. And so he's going out checking the course before today's grade one. And you know, I think it's just, you know, just a precaution, and like to make sure it looks good.
And Woodbury has been on with us many, many times. He prepares young horses, of course, and trains his own. And he was a little, I think he thought he might have on Monday outsmarted himself by scratching out of the stake to maybe go run. And he's got a couple of options that he's looking at for that nice. He's got that nice filly. I'm going to forget the name. Meadow, something Meadow, Mary Meadow. But Woodbury, terrific. Woodbury's my go-to to talk about bits. Whenever bits come up, and people are confused or interested or excited about bits, we go to Woodbury and he explains the differences, the nuances, you know, because if a horse has a form reversal, people assume only one thing is responsible for a form reversal. Yeah. It doesn't occur to them that you know, the headgear has been changed, the training methods. You know, yesterday with Sid Fernando, Miesta Approval came up. And you know, a horse that had totally soured, and the Carla Wolfson would spend hours on every morning, hours, until he finally walked through the gap at Calder and started to train again.
No, exactly. But look, yeah, I mean, that's horses for you. I mean, if you you know, if you try to come up with, you got to come up with different strategies and you know, change things up. And you know, that's the cool thing about in the morning. You watch trainers, you know, fiddling and niggling at things, different, you know, just changing things up, trying to come up with a strategy that might work. And that's the beauty of our game, the nuances of training horses. And yeah, that's the part that we love.
Well, we'd love talking to you because it transcends, you know, just the nuts and bolts of handicapping and the, you know, the general discussions. And on this topic, I mean, it's one of the things that you're writing and that the special has been able to do from a radio standpoint, Sean. Actually, I've got the luxury 3 hours a day, 5 days a week, that I don't have to shove everything in, you know, into a brevity, not my strength, and the beauty of the...
I'm glad you said it.
The beauty of the special is you've got, you know, this year 20 editions and, you know, fairly unlimited page space to tell the stories or to delve into things, and some of them, you know, have become absolute, you know, regular features and institutions in the special, whether it's a barn tour, whether it was the unbelievable conversations with Chief.
Yeah, of course.
That's, I mean, those are the ones, and now, I mean, it's basically become, you know, a how-to guide. It's like Preston Birch's How to Train Thoroughbred Horses.
Yeah. No, exactly. Look, that's what we wanted to do from the beginning. We started in 2001, and, you know, for me, I was galloping horses up here, riding races, and just watching these performances, and we really wanted to just bring it to the people who, you know, aren't able to see it from the same side of it. You know, I pride myself on trying to watch the race with who I think's going to win the race, and, you know, I've been here over the last 20 years. I mean, back to the Chief. I mean, I've told the story. It's that, yeah, when he won the Prioris, his last grade one Amazon Corps, I was walking up, and I kind of didn't know who I was going to watch it with. I was doing radio, actually, with Mike Penna. I was kind of juggling 50 things, and I remember kind of being near the winner's circle, and I was like, man, I should go watch this with the Chief. I mean, I didn't think he's necessarily going to win, but I'm like, you know, I ought to watch this with the Chief. And I knew where he'd be standing. He always stood in the chute of the paddock, usually kind of right down by himself. And I walked down and kind of stood behind him and watched. And, you know, he wins the grade one. And, you know, I'll never forget it. He turned around and gave me a high five that about knocked me down, you know. And I try to play it cool. Like, I don't really – I try to just be an observer, and you know, so I don't really want to be in the situation. But there's Chief. He, like, gives me a high five, about knocks me down. And then we walked up the track, just the two of us. We walked from the chute up to the winner's circle. And – you know, it's just the two of us. The crowd was just, you know, clapping for him. And I remember him looking there, and he kind of looked at me, and he's like, "Man, that's some applause or whatever." I said, "That's for you, Chief." And he just did that kind of humble, you know, shook his head. And so, yeah, that's been, you know, we've been doing that for, this is our 21st year, and we really, really try to bring that to the fans. You know, I'm lucky enough that I have, you know, I feel honored that I have the that I can stand next to the Chief and watch his grade one. Or, you know, when Shug won the Travers or Code of Honor, I thought he'd win, so I tracked him upstairs and stood there behind him as he won. And Shug is not, you know, he's quiet. He doesn't say a word. I'm like, you know, it's like, I need him to say, I watched the whole race with him. I'm like, he's got to say something for the story. And we walked down the back steps, and he kind of looked at me, and he said,
"Well, Sean."
Yeah, he said, "That was fun." You know, so, and I was like, "Wow, it was perfect." You know, like, "Wow, that's great." You know, so yeah, that's what we try to do. I mean, it's like, that's, you know, the stable tours, Phasic Tipton stable tour, we, you know, I literally walk up and down the shed row with Bill Mott every year, and, you know, he's just opening screen doors, and we're standing there, and he's like, "Well, what do you think of her?" And I'm like, "I know it's Royal Delta." You're standing there looking at Royal Delta going, like, "What do I think of her?" Like, wow, you know. So, yeah, it's a real honor. Look, we love the game, and we love bringing it to our readers, to the people out there, who can't, you know, they're never going to walk down the shed row with Bill Mott. So for us, that I keep saying an honor. We're honored to do it. I mean, that's really what we love to do. I mean, I feel privileged and blessed that I can do that.
Well, and it the way in which it brings the game, and I mean, obviously it's Saratoga specifically, but you guys do year round, and going back to steeplechase times, you know, same kind of thing. You are bringing the game, and I think, you know, I think the vast majority, obviously, of people that are dedicated in this manner, you know, and there's plenty that are doing it strictly for the love of the sport, and they aren't necessarily. I mean, if something, if they catch a wave and end up, you know, end up finding sponsorship and so forth, I mean, they'll that'd be great. They'll be thrilled. But I mean, I started my thing in Derby Trail in 2002, just wow, for fun, and you know, I kind of wanted to write. I did want to get on, you know, and I wrote a few stringer things for Blood Horse, but you know, I ended up coming in sort of through a side door, very differently. But whatever. Anybody that has a notion to do this is doing it because they're captivated by the game, and you know, having the experience that, you know, that you bring, and the intimacy that Joe, and when it comes to Tom, his professional journalism career, it's, you know, it's a unique triumvirate that, you know, offers a very different perspective and you know, near daily offering of the game. It's become indispensable.
No, I appreciate those words. That's what we wanted to do. I mean, I remember being up here when I was galloping horse up here for Wild Riding Race 13 years, and I knew I was finishing, I was retiring from riding, and I was up, you know, at Saratoga thinking to myself, what am I going to do, you know, what am I going to do next year? What am I going to, I broke my ankle in 2000 at the Saratoga Open House, so I missed the whole season. I mean, as I couldn't ride race at the regular meet, and that year, and I knew I was finishing up riding, and it was like, what am I going to do? I'm not going to be a trainer. I just was, you know, and I It's like, I wanted to come back here, and I needed some role. I'm not the type of person who's just going to come up and just be a fan for the season, which is nothing wrong with that. I mean, I love the concept, but I couldn't afford to do that. I mean, I couldn't just come up and I didn't want to just keep galloping horses so it was very much just like, what can we do? What can we do to be able to come back up to Saratoga and play some role and just try to play a role in the sport that we love. And, it's been an unbelievable ride for, 21 years. And, to share it with my brother, who's just, he's 5 years older than I am. And I always say, if it wasn't for my brother, I'd probably still be galloping horses. He really steered me and kind of guided me. And then Tom Law coming on board, that was a game changer. I mean, he's been here, I think, like 9 years, I think, is what he said the other day. I was shocked that it's been that long, but that was a complete game changer where he brought, he just stepped up our game, brought a total, another level of...
Managing editor.
Yeah. I mean, he was able, he's the one dealing with the writers and dealing with these interns and mapping it out. And he's an unbelievable writer, fast writer. I mean, he can write fast like I've never seen anybody, and write well. And then we're great friends. I mean, we always laugh. We work literally all day, every day. And then on a dark Monday, you say, well, what are you doing tomorrow? We go running, and we go to the state park and run the 5 mile trail. And what are we going to do for lunch? Well, let's go to Spring Street. And what are we doing for dinner? Well, let's go. I've probably never been around two. I've never spent more time with two people and never get tired of them. It's just, that's a real.
It's a rarity.
It's a rarity. And again, I feel blessed that they've had those two guys making positive difference in my life. I mean, it's just an unbelievable difference.
I haven't had this conversation with Joe. We talked about production a couple of weeks before the meet. Where was Joe? What was Joe? What was he doing? Where was he? It was the Steeplechase Times.
So, I mean, really, he's 5 years older than I am, so he was always, I mean, Joe was he was going to do everything kind of by the book. I mean, he's just one of those guys that's very much like, he's just steady. He's just steady as a rock. So he went to University of Delaware, journalism major, worked in a little local newspaper at Rehoboth Beach, The Whale, and then he was working at the Cecil Whig. Got Matt, fell in love with Sam, his wife, fell in love with her in college, married her. They were 1990, so he was 25. I mean, just very much like, that was, meanwhile, I'm riding races and smashing around the country and trying, just like living like just a complete vagabond. And we started 1990, so it was 1993. I actually read an article. I had won three races at a race meet, and I read an article in the Chronicle of the Horse about me winning three races. And they had all these mistakes in there. I had my age wrong. I'd come back from breaking my... I'd separated my shoulder, it said I broke my arm, and I just got all fired up, and I was like, man, this is crazy, like, nobody's covering this sport, somebody's got to cover this sport better than this. So I said to Joe, I said, we got to start a Steeplechase newspaper. This is crazy. Why can't we start a Steeplechase newspaper that covers this sport the right way? And he is one of the rare people that ever actually took one of my crazy harebrained ideas and like ran with it. And he called me back about a week later and said, this is how we're going to do it. We can do one next spring. Spring of 94, we'll do 7 issues bi-weekly in the spring, and then come back in the fall bi-weekly in the fall, basically every other week, spring and fall, and we'll do 14 issues total.
Wow.
He said, this is what the print bill's going to be. This is how it, and he said, I think it'll cost $5,000 to do 7 issues in the spring. If we don't make any money, we'll just close down and we'll blow $5,000. And then his next question was, do you have $5,000? And I was like, I actually did. I was riding races. I was single. I had money. I mean, I didn't have a lot of money, but I had enough money.
That's great.
And I had no expenses. I mean, I was like, I was bouncing between living at home and living with friends and coming up here and whatever. So I said, yeah, I can blow $5,000 on a Steeplechase newspaper. And so we started Steeplechase Times in 1994. We did 7 issues, and the company wrote Sean Clancy a check after the 7 issues for the $5,000, and I got my $5,000 back. And we've basically just been you know, rolling it. I mean, when look, it's not, you know, we're not, you know, Rupert Murdoch here by any means, but we've been able to make a living. We've had a lot of fun. It's been an unbelievable experience for the kids, for his, he's got three sons, that for them to grow up in it and my son to watch it. And, that was 1994. And, we did Steeplechase Times for almost 20 years, started the special in 2001. It's been a wild ride for sure. But he did, you know, when we started Steeplechase Times, he would go to the Cecil Wig where he worked. We would do the paper every 2 weeks, but for like 3 days every 2 weeks, Joey would put out the daily Cecil Wig. He was a sports editor. He would do all that, and then when that finished at like 11 o'clock or midnight, we would start on Steeplechase Times. Back then, we were laying it out, had these big boards, and you were cutting and pasting
sure.
and putting these.
I of mean, course,
it was madness. I was the greaser. I'd take the they get the photo and they'd Velox like the photo, and then I'd run it through this machine. I called it the greaser, and it would grease the back of it, and then I'd position those photos on a big board,
yep.
and then that would go into the, I don't know where it went, into the printer somehow, and then every other Wednesday at about 3 o'clock in the morning, Steeplechase Times would roll off the printer, and we'd pick them up and put them in the car and, you know, drive home, and then I'd go gallop horses at 5:30 or whatever. I mean, it was madness, but it was fun. I mean, it was fun, and, you know, I always tell people, look, if it's yours, you'll do, you know, it's amazing what you can do when something's yours, and so, yeah, it's been... been a wild ride, that's for sure.
Well, and Joe talked about some of the adventures, misadventures involved with production once you got going here, and that there's some funny stories involved there. But I got to ask you, I mean, did you know, how quickly did you realize that, you know, you talk about Tom as a deadline writer, how quickly did you realize that you had a gift as well in terms of storytelling?
Yeah, I don't know if it's a gift, but...
Well, craft. I mean,
yeah. I mean, like Steeplechase Times, I remember saying to Joey, we were working on the first issue, and he was the writer. I mean, he had gone to journalism school, but he was the writer. And we were talking about articles, and we said, well, we should write an article about... You know, back, I don't know who, whatever it was, you know, let's say Lonesome Glory. He said, we should write an article about the rivalry between Lonesome Glory, Warm Spell, and Mystico. I mean, he's three great horses. And I said, well, who's going to write that? And he said, you are. And I said, well, I'm not a writer. And he said, you are now. He said, get writing. You got to write. And so that's, I mean, I really just, he was behind that. And I told somebody the other day, I mean, he literally read every article I had ever written for any publication. Obviously, Steeplechase Times, Saratoga Special, but I was writing for the Blood Horse, Mid-Atlantic Thoroughbred, Racing Form. He literally read every article I wrote for, I mean, if I started writing in 1994, probably 20 years. I mean, he would read it, and then I would send it to the editor. I mean, that's how dedicated he is to helping his little brother. I mean, he would read everything and just clean up all, you know. And believe me, when I started, I mean, my grammar was terrible. I didn't know what I was doing. I mean, it was just... And then Steeplechase Times, really, 94 to 2000. And, you know, writing about steeplechasing was still like... It wasn't really like... the pressure of this. And then we came up here in 2001, and we had very little staff, and we're trying to do 6 days a week. I mean, it was madness. And I had never written so much so fast than that summer. I mean, that's when I really became that
proficient.
Yeah, I mean, because there was Joey was laying out the paper. I mean, he was the only one that could do layout, and I basically was the only one that could write. And yeah, I mean, I'd never written so much so fast, and that's when I really became, that's when I got my, you know, I had enough, that's when I really kind of got enough confidence to say, wow, okay, I can do this. And there was years, I mean, years and years of being up here that I would literally, I didn't know if I could write it. I mean, I would like you covered like the Travers. I mean, you walk out of here at 7 or 8 o'clock at night after the Travers, and you got a tape recorder full of notes, and you got, you know, your scribbled notes, your own observations, and I'd walk out of here, and I literally wasn't sure I could write it. I mean, I would go home at like I'd walk in the office at 8 o'clock with all this stuff, or 7 or whatever time it was, and I probably for 10 years at least 10 years I had this like, I don't know if I can do this, and then you do it. So at least now I no matter what, I know I can write it. It might not be as good as I want, or as, you know, as crafted the way I want, or whatever. But that was kind of a big breakthrough when you realize, like, okay. And for the whole paper itself, you got to a point where, like, okay, we can do this. We can pull this off. The first 5 years, at least, every night was like, can we pull this off? And you had this crazy, I mean, no, but I don't know why. I mean, we had this, like, just... like we had, you know, you couldn't let people down. Like you could not, you know. I always say I took the Saratoga special to the Morning Line kitchen. I did it myself every day we printed. I'd take it there and I'd put it on that paper rack at 5:30. I mean, first set goes out on track at 5:30, and I'd put that wouldn't matter if we went to bed at 2 a.m. I'd walk in and I'd put that paper on that rack at 5:30, and then one day I overslept. And I got to that paper rack at 6:15 or 6:30. And I put the paper on there. And you know what changed? Nothing. Absolutely nothing. Like, nobody gave me grief. No advertiser jumped up. Like, I kind of looked around like, I guess what, you know, this is, I guess we made it, you know, we made it enough that like I come out here at 6:15 and like, you know, nothing's changed. We still try to get on that paper rack at 5:30, but we know if it gets there at 6:30, we're still okay.
There's some of the more veteran, people that have been, you know, running the game in different arenas. The Wilkses, Team Wilkes, they have an expression. You find out that they'll run the races even if you're not there.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Yeah.
That's right.
Exactly. Exactly. Yeah, I remember when I retired, I remember, like, you know, the next season, like, wow, yeah, they're going to have these races without me. Wow. You kind of have this moment of like, yeah, it's going to go on. It's going to go on without me.
That's actually been, in some ways, that's actually a theme, not just for this season. It's really an ongoing overwrap to this sport, which is... nobody's bigger than the game, and you know, one monkey don't stop no show, yeah. And that needs to be, you know, people need to remember that and to acknowledge that this is, the game is the sum of everybody, but it's bigger, and it'll keep going.
No doubt, and that's how we kind of look at the special. Like, we just we've played our role, we've been able to enjoy the sport, and we've played our role and we've done what we can, and one day we'll be gone, and you know, I don't know what'll happen to the Saratoga special, who knows, but yeah, look, if people look back and say, remember that paper? That was, you know, that's cool. That's great, you know. Again, yeah, we need to make a living, and we love the sport, and you just try to figure out a way to, and you do the same thing. I think all of us do. I mean, you look around, I think everybody, I mean, we're sitting out here, Horseman's Credential. I worked, my second job in Saratoga was for Mike Freeman.
And oh, wow.
Lou Coble was the assistant trainer. Right. And that's where I met Lou. I mean, that was in 1990. I mean, that's a long time ago. And Lou's still here, and he, you know, it's like amazing.
Everywhere you go, almost every office and nook and cranny here that you walk into, you go across there to the Horseman's bookkeeper, and most people, owners, you know, people that are picking up checks, they don't realize that Denise Stampinato's name there is somebody that got on horses for Woody Stevens, yeah. and some of the best of Woody Stevens. Yeah. I mean, they're all over the place, and that's part of the charm of the game and of the industry.
No, no doubt. Exactly. And that's that's exactly right. You look around and you realize that, I galloped horses with people that now are, you know, in racing office or assistant trainers or stamping hands or whatever. And it's again, you love the sport and then you try to figure out a way to be able to work in the sport so you can still enjoy the sport. And that's really important. I mean, I think it's important to realize that and kind of remember that.
From a education standpoint and from a internship, because this is something I've brought up with all of you, with Tom, with you and Joe, and some of the people that are graduates of you know, Saratoga Special University, Clancy College, the ability to indoctrinate and to educate and develop talent is, you know, when I was at Procter & Gamble, they drive that into your head immediately that your own career is going to be advanced based on your ability to get people promoted, and right from the get-go, that's ingrained in you, that being able to learn a process and execute it, but then to be able to, you know, to train people to do the same thing successfully, there's a great reward in that in and of itself, obviously. And there's countless people that have come through the special doing different things. I mean, in a lot of ways, it's sort of like the RTIP, like the Racetrack Industry Program, and other nurturing kids to the cup, Trudy McCaffrey and Johnny D, what they did. I mean, you look around this building here, there are Elise Jacobs and Susie Rasher and Allie Kirchner and who am I for? That's just tip of the iceberg. Right. There's the couple dozen, and I've tried to suggest that should be, that concept should be, you know, rebooted. But being able to, you know, being able to advance people's career and interest in the game, there's reward in that as much as you know, putting out the paper and feeling good about, you know, what the issue represents.
No question. I mean, it started early. It certainly wasn't something we set out to do. I mean, we didn't have any of the Procter and Gamble kind of executive meetings and conversations about how to do that. But Quint Kesenick was one of the first. I mean, he had read the special, I think the first year we did it. He reached out and wanted to work with us, and he came here in the second year, worked 2 or 3 years with us, and he went on to ESPN. Is now, you see him in college football and lacrosse and different things. And then, you know, all of that, like Travis Stone, I remember he sent me an email. He had picked up the Saratoga Special in a picnic area. I remember reading his email. He said, "I'm from Scroon Lake, and I want to be a racetrack announcer." I'm like, "Well, great, okay." I said, "You know, how do I do it?" I said, "Well, come work for the special next summer." So he came to work for the special. Literally lived in the office. He had this kind of had a blow up mattress in the office, and he did a radio show from the closet. And but that was his real introduction to the sport. I remember it was very, I tell the interns now and kids that work with us, it was interesting when Travis applied for the job at Louisiana Downs as the announcer. And I remember he's told me that he said that he ended up, Louisiana Downs was looking for two positions: one to write press releases, handle that media,
sure, publicist,
a publicist, and they also needed a racetrack announcer. And they got Travis's resume, and he had his demo tape. It was one of the races was Chowder's First at Saratoga when he's working for the special. He'd stand up on the roof and call these races, and they said they got his resume. It was like, "Phew, here's our guy. He can do both." And they hired him to basically do both because of his experience with the special. So I tell these kids now, like, okay, just, you know, maybe you don't want to be a writer, and that's fine, but you need to have, you know, a lot of things on your resume, and you need, you know, you might get that job. And really think Travis got that job because of his experience as a writer. And again, Travis came to the special, he didn't have any dreams of being a writer. He just had dreams of being a racetrack announcer. I mean, that's what he wanted to do. And there's a lot of guys like that. I mean, John Panigot was a great example. I mean, he just wanted to get in the game.
That's right.
Went to college. sent me an email, said he wanted to be a jocks agent. I was silly enough to think, oh, well, why do you want to be a jocks agent? There's all kinds of better jobs than that. And I look back now, like, man, I should have tried to be a jocks agent too. But, and he eventually became, you know, a jocks agent and a racing manager. And, you know, he was able to use the experience of the special, the contacts, the people he met, and basically just, you know, kind of just paved his own way and created his own niche in this sport. And I think that goes for everybody. I mean, Gabby Gaudette came to us. She didn't know what she wanted to do. I mean, she's a good writer, actually worked hard, knew the game, and built a career. And Jim Mulvihill and John Lees and Pete Fornatel and Brian Natto. I mean, Ryan Jones, he's in the Army. He's going to like, he'll be president of the United States one day. I mean, he's an amazing kid and worked with us. Same thing. Didn't really want to be a writer, liked the game, just wanted to get involved, and met a lot of people and had a lot of fun. And you know, there's countless numbers, it's so important for our sport to give kids an opportunity to just get involved and get working at it. And I always say, like, the Darley Flying Start program is a brilliant program, and I've always suggested to them the industry should have a net to catch all the kids who don't get accepted in the Darley Flying Start program. Let's catch all those kids and try to get them roles in our sport. Some do, of course, but a lot of them probably don't. And you know, if you can get them involved. And I always say that it's so important. You have to get kids involved. You have to get them, you have to get them involved. They need to get jobs. They need to work in our sport, and then they become owners, trainers, whatever. I mean, they give back to the game. It's so crucial.
One of the challenges, and you've got the in fact you've. You know, wisened me up a number of times about frustration of the way in which you know, the game is portrayed and discussed publicly. And you know, the most obvious forum that has potential to, you know, proliferate interest and generate interest. At the same time, it's also doing the opposite, which is to sour people on the game. And from that standpoint, you know, the Twitter environment, somewhat so on Facebook, I guess, but I it seems like Twitter is the place where, you know, there's these brush fires of just, you know, really unpleasant moments and the worst, whether it's an accurate identification of an issue or whether it's completely unfounded speculation and runaway rumor mongering, to me, it seems like there's a higher percentage of negativity than positivity, essentially. And I wonder, you know, you told me a few years ago, I mean, just because people have a keyboard and they put it out there doesn't mean it's worth, you know, taking seriously or noting it. However, my bigger concern is much, I always kind of bring it back to the Naira franchise. During the franchise debate and during all the rancor, where the media, particularly New York media, Times Union and the New York Post, particularly, consistently, and the Daily News, consistently misportrayed everything that was going on with the Racing Association and was on the attack constantly and drove home big lies, to use a current moniker, you know, particularly about bailout of Naira. $30 million bailout. There was a loan that was in the documentation in the legislature that was then repaid. There was never, and people to this day, if you took a poll, You would get people say, oh, yeah, oh, Naira was bailed out. No, they weren't. It was advances against revenues from the gaming.
Right.
And the gaming, of course, was held hostage by the lottery division and by Pataki to try to steer it to Friends. And, all of that stuff that went on was so brazenly portrayed in a certain vein. And it leaves a perception. And my concern always is, Sean, that there's things being perpetuated and being put out there that have such a negative impression that people are left with, and they don't have either the I'm sure they have the interest. They don't necessarily know where to go look to get a alternate factual presentation. And that to me is such a danger and part of an atmosphere that seems to pervade of negativity, when in fact there's lots of good things to talk about. But yet predominantly when you go and look, they're buried under an avalanche of this miasma of negativity.
Well, I mean, today's forum is, I mean, if you, Twitter, for example, I mean, Twitter is so, it's not, I mean, I would say Twitter is not the majority opinion on a subject, because most people, the Twitter attracts this negative kind of slant. It's a negative bent, and people like to get on there
and vent.
You actually can't. It's so slanted toward negativity that you actually can't even go on there and defend or say offer because then you get attacked and you don't, then you don't like it. Just becomes, it just gets worse and worse. But it's like the negative voice has a bigger platform than any other voice when it comes to Twitter and social media, and that will only, that's only going to get worse, and I think it's obviously very, it's so detrimental to our sport and we're not, it's not just horse racing. I mean, we're in horse racing, so we're talking about horse racing, but it could go for anything. But I remember having a conversation with Pete Fornatale, and he said, he said, "I don't like that guy." I said, "What do you mean you don't like that guy?" He said, "Oh, he criticized J.K. Jonathan Kinchin." And I said, "What do you mean?" He said, "Well, he went on Twitter and he criticized his shirt." And I said, "Let's get this straight. So why on earth does this man have a platform to criticize a guy's shirt? And why would anybody care?" And so that's all. I mean, and it's like it's like so far gone, like that. Like why does anybody have a platform to criticize somebody's shirt? I mean, and that's where we are today. I mean, that's the society we live in. It's madness. I mean, if I don't like the shirt you're wearing today, Steve, I can literally go on Twitter and say, "That's Steve Bick wears terrible shirts." Well, like, why do I have that form? Why do I even, it's like, it's crazy where we are in today's world.
You mentioned about having things boomerang, and one of the things in 15 years of doing this, when there is a controversy and there is something involved and difficult to comprehend, needs to be put into perspective, when we go out of our way to try to bring people in to explain, and particularly when it comes to medication issues, and have done that from day one. And have the resource of people like Alan Foreman and RMTC, whoever it's been, Dr. Waterman and whichever doctor at the time I've brought forward, and that earns you identification as for the status quo. I want to see all the same things affected that everybody else largely would, but it's required that we explain and understand what we're talking about in each of these topics and each of these areas of concern. And I mean every single media generated controversy has been, in essence, have been inflicted, for the most part, have been inflicted on the industry. And, I mean, there's been episodes that have happened. You think about Barbaro and you think about Eight Bells, where, I mean, we didn't have an adequate media response plan, and how we continue as an industry not to have that kind of is confounding. But things that have been, attacks that have been created, including the shameful PETA, you know, what was done there, you would think would disqualify the people involved from ever having anything to say about the game, no matter how many you know, lovely bouquets are thrown from Fonner Park and Grants Pass. It is really troubling that you know, every time there's one of those missives, it's essentially a carpet bombing that you know, leaves scarred earth, and you know, having to fight back and build back from all of that every time is just, it's exhausting. And you do understand when you see people kind of throw up their hands and say I'm walking away, you can understand. But you know, trying to persevere and you know, keep bringing the game and the game's best qualities, you know, to a larger audience, you know, has to be your raison d'etre.
No question. I mean, that's what we all try to do, but unfortunately, and it goes back to the point I always make, it's like the reason we don't have a centralized message is because we're not a league, we're not
right.
a company, we're just, I mean, there's a bunch of individual racetracks competing against each other basically for the same thing. I mean, I've told you before, people say, oh, we need a commissioner. We need a league. You can't be a commissioner of nothing. I mean, what are you going to commission? You be commissioner of horse racing? There's no, horse racing is just, it's made up of a bunch of different individual racetracks and individual states all fighting for the same thing, and that's to me is really the struggle that we have. It's like this, the whole Triple Crown thing and the Baffert and the positive medication positive. It's like nobody's working together because you've got basically Triple Crown is three individual races at three different venues in three different states, all doing different things and handling it in different ways. And that's the part where it's just, I don't know how we ever improve that or escape that. I mean, that's where it's so fundamentally flawed to think. Because we always say, why can't we have, we need a unified message, but we're not unified. I mean, there's no, we don't have a league. We don't have, I mean, it's, so, you know, the different state rules and different jurisdictions, and it's just, that part is, it's so fundamentally flawed.
But at the same time, to recognize as part of that, the game is a victim of its own age and of its own heritage and history, because it predates any modern sport activity in this country, and because literally these leagues, these racetracks, these racing associations were being formed in the 1820s, essentially. Yeah. And so there was no other way for this to evolve. And one of the things I remember writing, one of my, I wish I could find some of this stuff, but my early, because I think Yahoo has gotten rid of all those. I had that Yahoo Club Derby Trail 2002-03-04 before I went on the website, created the website. I remember doing a piece, and I might actually have it written on. It might be on paper actually. I went and got headlines from, because I was collecting. Started collecting American racing manuals, and the, you know, the opening section of each arm, Evan Shipman and Charlie Hatton would write the year in review.
Yeah, brilliant. Yeah,
and I mean, if you want to learn the history, I mean, there's two ways to learn the complete, three ways, I suppose, to learn the complete history of the game, the history of thoroughbred racing in America by W.H.P. Robertson, and Racing in America by Tessio and or Vosburgh, and those opening sections in the American Racing Manuals. I put up five headlines. I'm going to find this for you. You'll get a kick out of it. I put up five headlines. And if at a glance, if you looked at the five headlines, they were ripped from today's, but they were from the 40s.
Right.
Every single one were topics that were still, you know, that were still being grappled with. Yeah. And I got the biggest, you know, I got the biggest kick out of it. I said, you know, you would be alarmed. Look at the headlines, and then I come back and say, well, except there's one problem. My favorite headline of that is, industry discusses aging fan base. Except that was from like 1938. They were worried in 1938.
Wow.
You know, we have all these old people at the racetrack. Well, who the hell else is going to be at the racetrack at 3 o'clock in the afternoon on a Thursday? Exactly. Right?
Yeah.
Who's going to be there? So there is all these things that have been you know, dogging the game for a long time, and that probably some things might get resolved by HISA. I guess we'll see.
We'll see. I mean, that's exactly right. We'll see. I think we've gotten to a point where it's like it can't get worse. So you're kind of hoping that maybe this is, you know, it's got to get better. But yeah, that to me, it's just hard to. You know, it's just where we're, again, we're not a league. We're just a bunch of different states, different racing jurisdictions competing. They're all competing for the same thing. So it's a really tricky structure to get right, to get people to get along, or, you know, like, you know, all the medication issues and all the other issues. It's fundamentally flawed because. It's like the, you know, the NFL is a league. The NFL works because everybody gets, they can have arguments and everything else, but they all ultimately come up with a decision, and then everybody has to abide by that.
Yeah.
And racing is, you know, and they have revenue sharing, which is a big part of it. And, you know, racing doesn't have revenue sharing where, you know, one of the track that's doing better gives money to a track that's doing, you know, worse or whatever. And I always say, I mean, one of the most striking concerns I have is that we've lost so many of these little tracks, and when I come to Saratoga, I always ask. I mean, one of the I like to delve into how people became owners, trainers, fans, and I mean, an overwhelming majority of them is they went to their little local track and fell for the sport, and
that's how
they became. I remember interviewing Gary West after he won the Traverse. I think it was West Coast, and I asked him, you know, how did you get involved? Why did you get involved? How did you get involved in racing? He said, well, I loved gambling. I was really attracted to gambling. When I was in college, he said the closest gambling venue was Aksarben Racetrack. He said, so I went to Aksarben. My friends and I went to Aksarben to gamble, because we love gambling. And then I gradually fell for the sport. I just fell for it. Like the horses, like the racing. I always said, you know, someday I'll make enough money, I'll own racehorses. And you think about today, the next Gary West, he's not going to Aksarben, certainly because it's closed, but he's not going to the racetrack. He's playing on. He's doing online poker or going to casino or playing. You know, he's not going to the local racetrack. He's not going to Suffolk. He's not going to Rockingham Park. He's not going to Atlantic City or Garden State Park or Aksarben or Hollywood Park or you know, Bay Meadows, or, you know, rattle off all the racetracks that have closed. And that's what concerns me, is, you know, where does the next fan come from if they're not introduced to it? You know, Vinny Viola. I did a column on Vinny Viola, and, you know, I asked him. I said, "How'd you fall for the sport?" And he said, "Oh, my dad. And my dad was a racetrack. I loved the track and went gamble. You know, handicapped every day and took me to the track. He watched Kelso win at Aqueduct, and as a kid, and, you know, wanted, his dad got sick. He wanted to own horses with his dad. His dad designed his own silks, and the last year and a half of his life, they owned a few horses. And dad died in 1999." 1989, and then he came back as an owner, you know, 10 years later. But like, what's little Vinny Viola doing today? He and his dad, they're most likely not going. I mean, they went to Aqueduct and Belmont Park. Those were two places. Are they going? Are those guys going there? No, I mean that's where we've.
Right, great.
I just don't know how we cultivate the passion and the love and for the sport for people to get involved. I mean, look, I'm here, Joey's here, and we're here because our dad trained horses, and I mean we went to every. I mean, I could rattle off 25 racetracks that don't exist anymore that we used to go to.
Well, Bel Air, Cumberland.
Oh my God, yeah.
Bowie. Yeah, I mean, right, just yeah. In Maryland alone,
exactly.
You can
yeah,
seven.
Right, and so that to me is one of the biggest concerns. You know, what's the next generation? The next generation? How do they even get introduced to the sport? This place obviously works. If the Saratoga Special goes on for the next 100 years, it will ultimately the people when you ask them that they're going to say, "Oh, well, you went to Saratoga with my dad, or my family went up to Saratoga." You're not going to get many saying, "Oh, yeah, I went to Axarbon," or you know, one of those kind of places. I mean, those places don't exist anymore.
It's scary, and we've discussed it repeatedly. Where I see people make the suggestion that, we got to get rid of Fairmont, and we got to get rid of places like that, and the low levels, and Finger Lakes, and whoa.
Yeah,
you better stop. And baseball's in for a rude awakening as well.
The minor league, with all this. Teams have shut down. Exactly. Same thing.
It's the dumbest thing I've ever seen. Yep. What do they think? Do they think that everybody that lives, let's say they live in Little Falls or in Auburn, New York, and you think that those people can go to Shea or to Citi Field and to Yankee Stadium and pay $60 for a ticket, etc., as opposed to going to a New York Penn League game right in their backyard and paying $4 for a ticket and introducing the game. I mean, my first game was at Fenway as a kid. We had season tickets. My father's business did, and we lived an hour and a half from Boston.
Yeah.
So that was. But my dad took me to the Yale Bowl to see college games. We saw, Harvard in the Yale Bowl. Saw the Giants in the Yale Bowl, 67 or 8, 68, I think. They played that season while the stadium was being renovated. But I completely agree that we're making a mammoth mistake by thinking that, we're not losing anything by losing a Suffolk Downs. And yes, people from New England are going to come here, and they do come here. But Lincoln Downs and Narragansett and Suffolk and Rockingham and then all of the fair circuit... to go from that to nothing is very dangerous, and the beauty is that when you bring people to a racetrack, their first race might be a nickel claimer. They don't, to them, it looks like the Kentucky Derby. They don't know. They have no idea the level of horses that they're being exposed to. And I also, I'll bring in. We got to bring in two aspects of this: the denigration of the party aspect of the game, where people make fun of the Pimlico infield. I came out of the Pimlico infield.
Yeah.
My continuity in terms of the game was three or four or five Preaknesses in a row with my friends from Alexandria, Phil Melnick and Skip Moser, and the bus trip that they would start with breakfast at their place in Alexandria, and then we'd bus up to Pimlico, go back, and then have a barbecue. It was an all-day party, and very slowly, got more and more interested. Phil and I started coming here, started going to Belmont's as well. Then I, when I moved back from to the U.S. from Canada, the fact that I was able to, be here on a daily basis. My first regular exposure was living in Brielle and going to Monmouth. That's where the first track I was able to go regularly. But that was in my late 20s and early 30s, and it got cultivated. We also,
the whole gambling discussion needs to be, you know, constantly reexamined, because we're not, we're collectively as an industry, we're not recognizing the importance of providing the right information and the right data and putting it in people's hands and cultivating their enjoyment of the game. We're already in trouble because it's a more costly wagering entity than, you know, what is now a you know, an obvious threat from sports betting. And we've had years and years to consider this, and there's been a countless array of well-meant horse players that have tried to, you know, slap the industry management around to, you know, be aware that you know, this is job one, as it were. I mean, there's several job ones. One is also cultivating owners, but cultivating players should be an absolute priority on a daily basis. And I mean, those are the bigger issues even than you know, the mainstream media perception.
No, look, horse players and horse owners, they're the same person. I mean, nobody's a bigger horse player than the horse owner. I mean, they're gambling when they buy horses, and the clash over that is to, I mean, I've listened to that and I've read that. Like, it's like, how are we clashing? I mean, everybody's in it together, and you need to look at it the same. Look, I, from the steeplechasing point of view, I mean, I promise you, I have watched flat racing basically marginalize steeplechasing. Critical.
That's a good point.
The writers, I mean, it's gone now, but I mean, the writing, I mean, you don't have those daily newspapers. But I promise you, for decades up here, certainly the 80s, 90s, when I was riding, the writers up here would just go, I mean, they just went on a, they went on a crusade to just vilify steeplechasing. Like, they had a bad day at the track, they lost money at the track because there was a jump race. I understand flat owners. I understand flat people don't, if you don't understand the game or don't like the game or aren't going to play the game, that's fine. But to go out of your way to marginalize steeplechasing while they didn't notice, flat racing is getting marginalized from the world, from everyday society. And that, to me, I mean, obviously I'm a steeplechase guy. Believe me, flat racing is better served if there's a sport of steeplechasing. I mean, when you look at the owners who got involved in steeplechasing first and then became flat owners, and you look at the Saratoga Special, if there wasn't steeplechasing, there would be no Saratoga Special. And I know I'm not making it out like I'm changing the world, but like, you need flat racing needs anybody who wants to own a horse, watch a horse, pet a horse. I mean, it's like going out of your way to like try to tear down polo or harness racing, whatever. Like, anybody who enjoys a horse for any reason is our friend, and that's our ally, and we all need to be together. And that, again, I am not, nobody in steeplechasing has ever said we're better than flat racing, we should be bigger than flat racing. But how people go out of their way to tear down steeplechasing while their game, flat racing, is basically being torn down without them even noticing. And that's just one example. Obviously, it cuts close to home to me. But like with the racetracks, I mean, again, people, they act like, we need contraction, we need fewer racetracks. Really? I mean, do you know how many people that are playing at Saratoga started with a little racetrack, with a little horse that got going, whether they're gambling, whether they own them, train them, ride them, whatever. And it's, that, to me, it's just so important to have a bigger point of view, a bigger perspective on what we need to do as a sport. And I mean, that to me, it's amazing. I promise you, I won the New York Turf Writers Cup in 1998. I, I'm a turf writer. I'm literally writing for the Blood Horse and Steeplechase Times. And I am a turf writer. I win a race on a horse named Hoken, who was a three-year-old for Lee O'Brien. We couldn't get the horse out of the barn. He wouldn't train. He would not go. We started schooling the horse, got him going. He finished third as a three-year-old up here in a maiden race on the grass. He literally would not leave the barn when we started. And he eventually became a steeplechase horse. I didn't sit on the horse from the time he left Lee O'Brien's as a three-year-old. I finished up here the last day I was here. I'd schooled him. He bucked me off on the baseball field, the bottom of the hill. He bucked me off at the top. He's by Trampolino, or notoriously mean.
Wow.
He bucked me off. In the history of my life, it never happened to me, and I've never seen it happen to anybody. He bucked me off. Michelle Nevin was galloping with us. Keith O'Brien, we're all out there galloping. He bucked me off the top of the baseball field. He slammed on the brakes and kicked me on the ground. He was kicking me on the ground. I'm huddled in a ball, and he's kicking me on the ground. I promise you, I did not sit on the horse. The last day I galloped for Lee O'Brien that summer, I went back to my real life. He was a three-year-old then. I didn't sit on the horse again until the paddock of the New York Turf Riders Cup 2 years later. He's 5 years old. He's the longest shot on the board against Lonesome Glory. I had not sat on the horse since the day he bucked me off, basically, as a three-year-old. I win the Turf Riders on him by a neck. Not the press, they have so little interest in the race. They send one guy down. They send the notes team guy down, and he interviews me in the winner's circle. I know exactly what I said. I said, for once in my life, it was like slow motion. I had everybody covered. I'm riding the race. I said, I got Lonesome. He's outside. I got him. Clearance Code's not going as well as I got him. Romantic's going well. Chip will leave it late. I got him. Kaiser's on Bisblends. I got him. Sundin's. I got everybody covered. I said, the race was in slow motion. I said, it was a great ride. It was just one of those rides. It was just a great ride. It just was in slow motion for once in my life. It worked. I mean, it was like...
Saw everything.
Do you know what a writer the next day? I read an article. I think it was the New York Post or New York Daily News. Hoken won the 94th running of the New York Turf Riders Cup and covered 2 3/8 miles in 4 minutes and 11 seconds, trained by Janet Alley, ridden by Nancy Gary, owned by Nancy Gary, trained by Janet Alley, ridden by Sean Clancy. And he says, apparently, Clancy was even impressed with himself. Quote, it was a great ride, end quote, Clancy said.
Oh my God!
And obviously, again, this is you asked me to be on the show, so I'm telling my story, but talk about, I mean, that's what he came up with, because he's sitting in the press box, and has such an attitude about steeplechasing, he thinks I'm saying it was a great ride, like meaning, I mean, anybody who knows me, would know exactly, and if you came down and actually heard what I said,
yeah,
you'd write it. So that was decades of being up here with the media, just the writers, they would just, their attitude towards steeplechasing. And again, that's fine. That's okay. But if you look at a bigger picture, you realize that you don't want to marginalize steeplechasing as flat racing is being marginalized. And that goes for, you don't want to marginalize Finger Lakes as the NYRA circuit is being marginalized from mainstream society, right? Fewer people are going to Belmont Park. Fewer people are enjoying racing. Fewer people are owning. So that to me is so crucial when it comes to horse racing, to have that bigger, you just have to have a wider lens and a wider view of it to realize that we all need to be together. We all need to be pulling in the right direction, whether that's racetracks, whether that's steeplechase. I mean, you know, I think harness racing, flat racing, steeplechasing, polo, fox hunting, horse show jumping, eventing.
Yep.
Like, the people own Don Little, Centennial Farm. I mean, he was a show. He loved, he rode show jumps. I mean, he loved show jumping. Florida, you go to Palm Beach. I mean, everybody's playing they're all playing the game. The amount of people that came out of polo and became racing people. So don't marginalize polo. Embrace it. It's just,
I agree.
To me, it's just so crucial for the survival of the sport that we love.
I'm the exact same frame of mind, and I, you know, over the years, people have, I'm sure some people, you know, have sat through and listened to
you know, the segments I've done about equestrian life, and you know, I've tried to kind of incorporate it. And if there's something that, you know, latch on to, you know, had probably the probably have had more eventing and equestrian than quarter horse conversations, actually. You know, have tried to have some legends on when it comes to harness and so forth. I completely agree. It's look who's here. I completely agree. It's for everybody. Anything that's got four legs, a tail, and a mane, we're for it.
Yeah, I mean, that to me is just perspective. You have to take of our sport and try to work together.
Good luck today.
Thanks.
Good luck today. Are you going to be dressed up?
Of course. I got to get out of this, you know, jeans and hat and, you know, baseball hat, and yeah, it's AP Smithwick, man.
But Patty Smithwick today, and was looking forward to this kind of a visit, and a wonderful hour plus with Sean Clancy. By Sean Clancy on your Twitter machine, Gibraltaro today for the River D Stables, and Jack Fisher, of course, and Waters.
Graham Waters rides.
Waters.
Yeah, leading rider right now. Nice kid. He's got an opportunity this year. Ride first call for Jack Fisher. He's making the most of it.
Good trip. Get the same kind of ride you got in the Turf Riders.
Yeah, that was once. That was once in my life.
And don't think that I'm not on newspapers.com finding the article to see exactly who we're talking about.
Yeah, you can look it up.
Yeah, I will.
I'll save his name. I'll save him. He probably doesn't remember writing it.
Unbelievable. Sean Clancy, everybody. 90 minutes in. Let's take a break. And probably our only one of the morning. I know Dick Powell is standing by. Seth Merrow's got his own golf cart. This is unbelievable. It's the Merrow Mobile. And Seth is going to sit in. We got to talk to Tony Black as well. Fabulous first half. Sean Clancy, everybody. Back after this.
It's At the Races with Steve Bick on Sirius XM Radio.
There's a great story to tell in Pennsylvania. Only three states have produced more Breeders' Cup champions, and no state can match our performance in recent years. Since 2016, our numbers of mares bred has skyrocketed, unlike the national trend. And this year's live foal report shows Pennsylvania up over 50%. Why? Our incentives and bonuses are the best in North America. Please visit us at PABred.com and see why Pennsylvania is the premier place to breed and race.
Why, in the past decade, has BRL Equine become the premier equine supplement company in the industry? Because we spend millions in research and development before we ever put out a product. Because we use only FDA-supervised facilities to manufacture for us. Because what we say is in them, is in them. Because they work. Because if you're not happy, I'll give you your money back. And because top trainers and veterinarians in thoroughbred racing, standardbred racing, three-day eventing, and barrel racing all trust in BRL Equine. Shouldn't you? To find out more how Flexify HA, Unlock, Bleeder Shield, and EPO Equine can help you, contact me, Joseph Vellante, 215-501-6880.
Horsebills.com is a cost-effective, time-saving, paperless revolution. Vendors are able to generate electronic invoices for owners and other vendors who can pay through Horsebills.com for just...